Kennedy is risking chaos.
Welcome to Politicology. I'm Ron Steslow, and this is our weekly roundup, where we invite a rotating panel of experts to discuss the truth you need to know behind the most important stories of the week and how they're shaping the political landscape. On our stupendous panel today, returning to the roundup, Lucy Caldwell, a veteran political strategist and tech founder. She's board advisor at the Renew Democracy Initiative and a former senior political advisor at the Goldwater Institute. Lucy, as always, it's great to see you. Welcome back.
It's great to be with you.
Also returning to the roundup is Liam Donovan. Liam has nearly two decades of experience working at the intersection of politics and policy. He's currently a principal at Bracewell LLP and spent two election cycles at the National Republican Senatorial Committee, which is where we work together. He's also a host of the great podcast called The Lobby Shop. Liam, welcome back.
Good to be here.
Up first this week, we'll discuss No Label's decision not to field a ticket and the impact that RFK Jr. could still have on the presidential race. Then Donald Trump is now on defense in the abortion debate, and we'll look at what the recent Arizona Supreme Court ruling could mean for the elections in November. After that, we will dive into Joe Biden trying to cancel student debt, again. Then we'll find out what other political developments Lucy and Liam are paying attention to and why. And finally, in a separate episode only for Politicology Plus members, we will discuss a new book, Lying About Rural Americans, and how scapegoating them is creating a blind spot in one of the biggest threats for democracy. If you are a Politicology Plus member, thank you. Politicology would not exist if it weren't for you. And if you are not yet a member and you want to join us there, go to politicology.com/plus to access all of those hidden episodes without any ads and join an informed and thoughtful community of pro-democracy listeners who help keep this show going. To level up right now, go to politicology.com/plus. Or just click the link in your show notes. So one of the big question marks about the presidential election has been who will be on the ballot besides Biden and Trump. And this week we have one big change. There will not be a No Labels ticket. They couldn't get a top-tier candidate. They were turned down by Haley, Christie, Larry Hogan, even the former lieutenant governor of Georgia, Jeff Duncan, turned them down. And people like Lucy and Matt Bennett deserve a ton of credit for this. Chris Christie was perhaps the most explicit in why he wouldn't run on the No Labels line. Quote, if there is not a pathway to win, and if my candidacy in any way, shape, or form would help Donald Trump become president again, then it is not the way forward. While there is a conceptual appetite for a third choice in the upcoming election, there was not a practical path to victory. No Labels national director, Joe Cunningham, told Fox he would vote for Biden over Trump. And Democrats have now shifted their focus to RFK Jr., who last week said that Biden is a greater threat to democracy than Donald Trump. His campaign also sent a fundraising email that called the January 6th rioters activists, although they apologized for it the next day. But then they also doubled down on the idea that it wasn't a true insurrection because the rioters weren't armed. Narrator, they were. Scott McFarlane pointed out that many defendants have pleaded guilty and acknowledged carrying weapons. It got worse over the weekend. Rita Palma, who identified herself as the Kennedy campaign's state director in New York, is pitching Republicans to support Kennedy by arguing that he will help Trump win the election. She called getting rid of Biden her number one priority. And her argument is that if Kennedy is on the ballot in New York, Trump has a better shot at winning the state. If Kennedy is able to get on the ballot in multiple deep blue states, it could create a contingent election where the House delegations will vote, almost assuring a Trump victory. The Kennedy campaign, for their part, in response, downplayed Palma's role and denied that that was their strategy. They said they only hired her to schedule volunteer shifts for gathering signatures in New York and that she is not involved in their electoral strategy. And on Wednesday night, Kennedy's campaign manager tweeted that Palma had been fired. Okay, Lucy, victory lap time for you, I think, and Matt Bennett and everyone else who has been aligned in the anti-No Labels effort. What does their decision not to field the ticket show about the lack of viability for third parties, at least at the presidential level this year?
Well, thanks so much, Ron. And first of all, kudos to Joe Cunningham for coming out and saying that he will support Biden, because that was finally a moment that was like, okay, we're not living in a total crazy land, right? Like, thank you for acknowledging that these threats are not equivalent. Credit to No Labels for backing off of that. And I hope that they will use the infrastructure that they built over the course of the last 2 years to help reelect Joe Biden, who is not comparable to Donald Trump and who needs to be reelected as president of the U.S. for all of those of us who are fans of democracy. So that's what I'll say about No Labels. I think and how they've positioned themselves after. I think it's also just a moment to pause and remember that one of the things that people have gotten really swept up in this cycle is the idea that there's unprecedented appetite for a third party ticket, that we've just never been in a moment like this before, and that, you know, this is the unique moment for a third party ticket. The data tells us that's actually not correct. That's not right. The appetite for a third party is actually not massively bigger than in previous cycles. It's lower than in some previous cycles. But more importantly, even if it were, an appetite for a third party ticket really is just a metric of when people were, you know, polled, did they say, do you want someone other than the two choices that are currently on offer? And a whole lot of people will say yes. But those people who say yes, those are not the same people, right? Some of them want Cornel West. Some of them want Larry Hogan. Some of them want RFK Jr. More still want Jill Stein. And so the No Labels found out the hard way that you can't just take a number like this is the appetite for a third party ticket and then extrapolate from that, that all of those people are going to vote for your chosen guy. And we saw this in polling because guess what? We polled every person that they were remotely considering for this ticket. The person who polled the highest, actually, among the Republicans that I was involved in polling and in analysis of viability of a No Labels ticket, the person who polled the highest was John Kasich, and he still didn't crack 10%, right? So I think that is a super important thing to remember. I am a big fan of the idea of new parties. I want to have more parties. I want to build something new. That is work that I would love to make my life's work. And actually, this moment in time that we're in is really troubling to me because I actually think that we have gotten into this. It's like an outgrowth of this toxic populism moment where there's this idea that we just throw stuff against the wall and any third party effort is something to be applauded. And it's truly painful for someone like me because I do want new parties. I'm an independent. I don't have a home in either of the two major parties, but I also see that there's a difference between wanting more choices and being just agents of chaos and being sort of like a blow up the system person. And that's what a lot of these movements have become. So super glad that No Labels backed off of it. Hope they use their infrastructure for good. And now it's just vital that we use all that we built in fighting No Labels to fight back against these other third-party tickets, because that ultimately is the Trump campaign playbook. These third-party tickets are essential to the Trump reelection strategy, and people should be extremely clear-eyed about that.
Fully agree. Co-sign all of that. Really well said, especially as a fellow independent. I'm with you in that space. Just, this is not the way. So Liam, now that they are off the board, now that No Labels, potential ticket is now off the board, and all this attention is being now focused on Cornel West, Jill Stein, and most notably RFK Jr., how now does that change the dynamics of the race? Last week, we talked about the first real battleground state research measuring the RFK Jr. factor, because there's been a big question mark, at least as far as I'm concerned, on who he's going to hurt more. And we haven't really known. And a lot of people have very strong opinions about that. This polling from the Wall Street Journal showed that his candidacy hurt Biden in Georgia, Michigan, and North Carolina, helped Biden in Wisconsin, and it was pretty much a wash in Arizona, Nevada, Pennsylvania. So, how do you think that changes the nature of the race? And with that in mind, what do you make of the move to call insurrectionists activists and January 6th not a real insurrection? Strategy or blunder?
So let me back up. Let's take it one at a time. So first and foremost, in terms of the impact that No Labels sort of sidestepping this has, I think the value of something like a No Labels type, the resources and the organization around No Labels was formidable in the sense that if you got a candidate there, you could trust that these people understood how to get on ballots, how to run a credible campaign. It was a campaign organization in waiting that never materialized. Now you're left with the folks you mentioned who, you know, are running some varying degrees of shambolic kind of vanity exercises. And so it's not quite clear yet, number one, how serious they are. Number two, what their goals are in doing this and fundamentally where they will appear on the ballot. And part of the issue is, you know, we have a bunch of press releases from the RFK Super mm-hmm. PAC indicating which states they're on. No Secretary of State has said, yes, you're on. So until we see from, you know, look, remember, we can look at national polls all day. We can talk about national elections all day. This is going to come down to 6-7 states tops. So the only question is, who is on the ballots? Who are the choices these people have? As Lucy said, people, you know, there's a general malaise, a general dissatisfaction with who we're choosing between. But that does not mean, as Dean Phillips found out, you can't just show up as, hey, I'm an alternative, and people will show up and vote for you. That's just not how it works. People are in a sour mood, but generally they still are, you know, voting in terms of negative partisanship. And the real question is the vessel that best sort of represents that. So No Labels falling away, I think, you know, they had some latent power there. And now, so we're left with this unorganized people with, you know, some name idea. I think if you look at the numbers, there are, I think the RCP average, there's like 13%. Kennedy's still at like 10%, which of course, as we know, like since Perot, nobody's gotten double digits. And when he did it, you know, the first time was the you know, real breakthrough, but that was the first time since Wallace in the 70s. This is anomalous. This doesn't tend to happen. And even Gary Johnson in 2016 was getting like 8, 9, even 10%. So we can expect this will come back as people wrap their heads around who they're actually going to have to choose between. Who does it help? Who does it hurt? Look, Donald Trump, what he's shown in 2016, 2020, straight on, he has a high floor. He has an exceptionally low ceiling, but even the people who are Kennedy curious, you know, Trump voters who like Kennedy, they like Trump just fine. So they're, you know, it's less of a threat in terms of who might be so, you know, dissatisfied with Trump. They're probably not going to leap to Kennedy. You know, the Haley voter, was probably a Biden voter in 2020. So Biden is the one that needs them. And, you know, so I think there is risk for both sides. Different states play different ways, but consistently what we've seen in national polls and state polls, invariably, you take what's a tight race with a very narrow Trump edge in a two-way ballot, that margin grows, not huge, but it takes, you know, a 1-point lead or a half a point lead. It goes to a 2-point lead. It goes for a 3-4 point lead. So it's consistent. Why that is, I think, is an interesting question to tease at, but it's unquestionably, you know, when Biden is the one who needs to cobble together this majority and, you know, repair this frayed coalition. And remember, it was a situational coalition. You had a lot of people who were erstwhile Republican voters who maybe voted third party, quite frankly, in 2016. And remember, that's the fundamental question here is how much of the vote goes to the two main parties? In 2020, that was 98% of the vote. And that's why it was too high of a bar for Trump to overcome. In 2016, only 94% voted, you know, to Republican or Democrat. That gave him the opportunity to win with 48% of the vote in the states that matter. So it's going to come down to, in 6 or 7 states, is Kennedy on? Is West on? And to the extent they are on, how much do they lower that threshold for victory for Trump? Because if it comes down to the point where 47-48% is good enough, you can bet he's going to have that. So Biden needs to convince people that things like the Arizona decision, things like the democracy concerns, you know, you mentioned Kennedy talking about January 6th and those sorts of things. Those are obvious blunders that don't help him and maybe give Biden an opening to say, hey, people, wake up. You might not like what you're seeing here, but 4 more years of Trump is not what you want. And that's what you're going to get if you vote for Kennedy.
I'm curious who you think he helps and who he hurts, whether you think this positioning was intentional. In terms of spoilers, we saw Nicole Shanahan after he chose her, say, yeah, we are going to be a spoiler for both Biden and Trump, which is how they're sort of pitching this campaign, which obviously, you know, it doesn't make any sense. And it seems to me at least difficult enough to read at this stage. And also there's the Libertarian ticket possibility, right? I don't know if he's still flirting with that, but it's possible that they will have ballot access in all 50 states if he teams up with the Libertarian Party. Isn't that right?
That's sort of right. I mean, I think a lot of their ballot access challenges are solved because they picked Nicole Shanahan as his VP for one reason and one reason only, which is that she has the ability to spend millions and millions of dollars on ballot access for RFK and herself now in a way that then facilitates their ability to pay amounts for ballot access funding that they would not have been able to raise for. So a candidate and his running mate, the candidates are allowed to what we call self-fund, right? That's the whole reason for the basis of the choice of Shanahan. So will they pursue the Libertarian ticket or not? Hard to say. It seems like there's at least, there are factions within the Libertarian Party who feel like this is really a bridge too far. And even some of the folks who had been boosters of RFK, like the chair of the National Party, have signaled publicly that they're very turned off by Nicole Shanahan. So I think although the Libertarian Party has been in disarray, and again, I don't know why you'd be more turned off by Nicole Shanahan as a Libertarian than by RFK Jr., but whatever. I think maybe the Libertarian Party is finding its core a little bit, that, you know, if you are going to be a hyper ideological third party, then you probably need to at least behave in a way that furthers your ideology, not just purely in favor of party power, for party power's sake. TBD on that. Don't have high hopes for the Libertarians. In terms of whom RFK Jr. hurts more, look, we don't totally know. But here's what we do know, and this is something that we have talked about on the show a lot. Donald Trump has a very high floor and a low ceiling. That is, Donald Trump has just these supporters who are just baked in for him. There is just nothing to do to pull them off of him. They are so hardcore. His ceiling, that is, people who are not sure whom they're going to vote for, who are open, relatively low. Joe Biden has a low floor and a high ceiling. Joe Biden has a weaker base of support than Donald Trump does, but he has much more potential to grab a big share of the electorate, a much bigger potential to grab the people that we talk about as double haters or double doubters, people who came home to Joe Biden in 2020 and maybe are more on the fence now, but we would hope that they would do that. And I actually think that recent polling of head-to-head matchups reflects something that we have also talked about on Politicology, which is the idea that now that people are facing up to the fact that this is a Trump-Biden rematch, they're remembering what Donald Trump is like, their reality is setting in, and we could see them embark on that journey. Given that ceiling floor piece, from the perspective of people who want to ensure that Joe Biden is reelected, we have to assume that RFK's inclusion in the race, just hurts Biden more, because Biden has the potential to grab more of those people between his floor ceiling. And so while we don't know specifically, and while there are a lot of nuances of individual policy issues or how RFK and Nicole Shanahan get packaged, I think it's pretty safe to assume this is more of a threat to Joe Biden. And that's why the Trump campaign is behaving that way too, because they agree.
Yeah, go ahead, Liam.
Well, and to Lucy's point, this actually popped in the New York Times earlier this week. And, you know, it reads as sort of Bond villain giving away his plan preemptively. But it's a piece by Maggie Haberman, by Jonathan Swan, a couple others over there, that lays out the sort of secret plan that the Trump administration or the Trump campaign has to sort of boost Kennedy in certain ways that leans into exactly what Lucy's talking about, which is exploiting that sort of low floor, high ceiling that Biden has. And so if you think about, you know, part of the Kennedy allure is just the name and the general awareness and association with the family. But if you think about who, you know, his career and how how he might fit into the issue matrix here. What they've come up with is they want to, especially as things like Arizona pop, you know, of course that hurts Trump and you know, hurts Republicans generally. People might not want to vote for Republicans, but you're angry, your person who's angry about abortion and won't vote for Trump could perhaps be convinced Robert F. Kennedy is a champion of choice and he's the guy that you can park with and feel good about it. So that would be just fine. You don't need to vote for me, but if you can defray him to Kennedy, that's good. So one is choice. One is his environmental record. Obviously, that was his background as an environmental lawyer. So trying to play up his, you know, Green Party bona fides, that sort of thing. And that actually works to West as well. And then the third is particularly in Michigan, but really everywhere, is leaning into the Gaza-Israel dynamics. And so I think they're very well aware of which elements of the left coalition of the 2020 Biden coalition is on the fence and probably is never going to come out and vote for Donald Trump, but they don't need him to. All they need to do is to either stay home, that's perfectly fine, or to the extent they come out, to vote for one of these other options and stick it to, you know, both sides. And so I think Lucy's exactly right. The risk is the problem for Biden. You know, risk and chaos are always good for Donald Trump. Risk and chaos are bad for Biden. Kennedy is risk and chaos.
Okay, that's a good segue to abortion, because Democrats are banking on intensity around abortion of abortion rights and reproductive freedom to boost their performance in November. And Trump now recognizes that he's got a problem. He put out a video statement that questions about abortion should be left up to the states. He did not support a national ban, although he's still eager to take credit for overturning Roe. And he's now getting hit from the right. The president of the Susan B. Anthony Pro-Life America put out a statement about her disappointment in Trump. Mike Pence called it a slap in the face to pro-life Americans. And even lapdog Lindsey Graham wrote on X that he respectfully disagrees with Trump. We've also got now, as you mentioned, the Arizona Supreme Court ruling, which is that an 1864 law banning nearly all abortions is enforceable. Anyone who performs one or helps a woman obtain one would be guilty of a felony with a 2 to 5 year prison sentence, and there are no exceptions for rape or incest. An abortion can only be performed if the mother's life is in jeopardy. In 2022, Arizona passed a 15-week ban, and a lower court ruled the 15-week ban superseded the 1864 law. So the Supreme Court looked at this question and said, no, it didn't supersede it, that in fact the 1864 law was enforceable. So for context, Arizona has 59% of Arizona registered voters said abortion should be mostly or always legal. That's as of an October New York Times Siena College poll. And in a March Fox News poll, 39% of Arizona voters said abortion would be extremely important in deciding their vote. 32% said very important. Trump did say the Arizona decision goes too far and needs to be corrected. And he also said on Wednesday that he would not sign a national abortion ban. So, Lucy, what does this show about how the Trump team, or at least Trump anyway, is thinking about abortion as an election issue?
Well, I don't think that it's news to anyone that Donald Trump is not a highly ideological guy. So he's trying to thread a needle where he both wants credit from people on the right, especially the anti-choice right, that he delivered them the Supreme Court bench that overturned Roe, but also now he's backtracking because it turns out that this is an extremely unpopular issue, or rather Republicans' position is extremely unpopular. And that's why he's suddenly saying, well, this goes too far, or I wouldn't sign an abortion ban of that sort, yada, yada, yada. But he has previously said he would. And the other thing that Donald Trump is doing, and also other national Republicans, is that they are doing this thing where they're like, you know what? States' rights, it's up to the states, and not expressing a position. So ultimately, really is going to be the responsibility of voters and also of the media, of people who are facilitating debates, of people who are facilitating fora, of candidates, to demand that we really truly understand not only what Donald Trump's position on abortion is, but also the position of other Republicans, both running for federal office or running down ballot. Because basically, we know Republicans are the dogs who caught the car on abortion, but now they're in this position where they just will not state what their position is. Sometimes some of them will say things like, let's just do a 15-week ban, right? Like, that's just, you know, wipe your hands of it. But we need to know where they stand on it. And as others have already said, I mean, Michael Steele said this last night, do not trust whatever Donald Trump tells you, because he has previously said that he will be, that he would sign a national abortion ban. It will be really interesting what the dynamics turn out to be in states where abortion will also be on the ballot. In Arizona, for example, there will be a major ballot initiative that really would provide quite significant constitutional protections for women up to a much further time in their pregnancy and even beyond in cases where the mother's life is at risk. But it's also going to be a dynamic on ballots in states that are less swingy, right? Arizona is an example of a state where that's really consequential, because we are waiting to see how will Arizona go. Will it go for Biden or Trump? But it's also going to be a factor in places like Florida, places that we would actually imagine Donald Trump has locked. And so we know that when abortion is on the ballot, Democrats do better, Republicans do worse. And so I think it is incumbent on us to not allow Donald Trump to do this slippery thing of sort of like sidebarring the abortion issue, because it is obviously quite consequential.
So in trying to figure out whether this is actually a winnable fight for him and whether or not he can actually thread the needle. So Leon, I think you and I have talked about this, that sort of abortion and immigration or border security are sort of linked in a very important way, because of the cross pressure that those two issues exert on a single constituency that may end up deciding this election, that is women in suburbia. And obviously, legally speaking, Dobbs sort of leveled the playing field between the pro-life and pro-choice movements, as Lucy's talking about, but by forcing them to duke it out at the state level. And now that it's being put to the voters, we're seeing the pro-life movement over and over and over again losing, not just in states like Vermont and California and Michigan, but they're also losing in places like Kansas and Kentucky and Ohio. So I think it's telling that we're now seeing Trump at least acknowledge he has an abortion problem and trying to sort of squirm out of it and soften his position or just avoid the debate altogether. But at the same time, the Biden team is now acknowledging he has a terrible border problem and he's trying to strengthen his position, right, by sidelining his progressive Latino consultants and getting ready to take executive action that is arguably to the right of where Trump governed on immigration and border security. By dramatically limiting the number of asylum seekers who can enter the country. The White House, by the way, is, for our listeners, is not completely sure that they believe he has the authority to do it, but Biden just gave an interview implying that he might do it anyway and let the courts shut him down. So I guess the question is, for me, it's kind of difficult to think about whether you can win one or the other issue without thinking of them as sort of paired when it comes to winning a presidential election in key geographies because of the constituency that they are both sort of cross-pressuring. So that's the one question. Second is, what is the effect of abortion being on the ballot in like Florida and Arizona? Are there any others where we have abortion referenda in the six or seven battleground states?
I think there's a number. I don't know that it's baked. I think there's still efforts afoot, and it really comes down to which states allow for referenda and you know the processes by which that happens. But there's an efforts to make it happen in a bunch of places. It doesn't necessarily overlap cleanly with the battlegrounds. But to your point, I mean these have mattered everywhere. It's mattered in Kentucky. It's mattered in Ohio. It's mattered in all sorts of states. But to your question, I think linking there's interesting parallels with immigration and with abortion, not least. I mean, you sort of, I think you raised the question in a provocative way, is there any winning this? And there's not winning this for either guy on either issue. You can't win it. The best you can do is parry it, neutralize it, try to depress it as the most salient issue. And that's the issue matrix heading into November is going to be one of the most important things. In addition to who's going to be on the ballot where, it's going to come down to what is the mentality of the voters as they're heading into the ballot box. And the more that is going to be about abortion, be it because they're hearing about it in their states, in the media, because it's on the ballot itself, or you know, whether that's crowded out by immigration headlines, whether it's crowded out by the their mental state of just having to afford daily life amid not just inflation, but just the price creep of everything we're doing. And so that's the tension here is, you know, Trump would love nothing more than to talk about immigration while Biden tries to do whatever he can, not to win it, but to just set it aside to try to cauterize it as much as possible. You know, as you said, they've been teasing these executive actions since February. And while also musing about how they can't, which harkens back to the Obama administration, where for, you know, years he said, well, I can't do it. I need Congress to act. And then he finally just did it. And they used that against him in the courts and whatnot. And so, you know, to your point, though, I think a lot of this is about getting caught trying. If he can say, hey, you know, whoops, I tried, the court stopped me, I can't do anything about it, that way the groups aren't as mad as you, because that's the other, you know, there's coalitional dynamics. It's not just about suburban women or college-educated voters, it's really about you're caught between your own base. So while, you know, Biden is being pretty ginger about this because his immigration-related groups and minority-related groups are mad about those reports, it's probably not bad for them to be mad. But in the same way that Trump picking a fight with Susan B. Anthony's list is probably the best thing he could have asked for. Until Arizona comes along. I think when they planned that announcement, getting the reaction they did from Susan B. Anthony, that was right exactly what they planned. It was the sister soldier moment. The problem is when abortion actually escalates the next day, that was not what they planned on. So, you know, can you win it? Of course not. You definitely can't. But you desperately need to keep it from being what people feel like the election is about. You know, I think to the previous issue of, you know, the steel point, I think I see people saying this a lot, and it's like, well, we can't believe Donald Trump. Well, of course, you shouldn't believe anything Donald Trump says. If there's nothing else about the man, like, we just know he's going to say whatever he needs to say to get through 10-minute increments of time. Literally, like, he sort of admits it. Like, there's some, that's part of his appeal. He sort of winks at the camera and says, you know, this is, I'm just doing what I have to do because that's the most, you know, that's what I need to say. But nobody actually believes he's, to Lucy's point, he's not an ideologue. He's, you know, that's part of his appeal is he doesn't believe any of this. He's very transactional. And if the transaction question means he has to not sign a national abortion ban, well, that's probably where he is anyway in his heart of hearts if he has one. So, you know, it's the tricky thing for Democrats isn't convincing people that Trump means what he says and he's convicted in being pro-choice or whatever. No, it's like it is convincing people that he actually cares about this issue when he doesn't. But that doesn't change the fact that there are lived realities here that are going to seep into people's mentality that are going to energize folks. And so it is absolutely a problem for Republicans, and they need to. You know, we got 207 days left until the election, I think, something like that, you know, less until they vote. And you need to keep this from being something that that is driving the news, that is driving voters' concerns. And the funny thing is, in Arizona, particularly because it's so cartoonish, the idea that you'd go back to a Civil War era pre-statehood law is ridiculous, and so ridiculous that I haven't heard. I guess there are people that have said, you know, Carrie Lake in 2022 said this is a good law or whatever. Nobody's actually defending this. And the easy thing to do in theory would just be to repeal it. And then it reverts back to the 15-week ban that they passed in 2022. But because of those base dynamics, they actually can't do it. I think, you know, maybe with some help from Trump, that would make it a little bit easier. But there's a pretty reasonable fix here that they just can't get it together to do. And so, you know, whereas in Alabama, they were able to scramble and go, okay, well, we don't want to be totally crazy. We can't be against in vitro fertilization. Like that's a terrible place to be. But with this, it does pitch you against your base in the same way that Biden is worried about the groups Republicans in Arizona. Maybe not Trump. Trump is bold enough and strong enough to pick a fight with Susan B. Anthony's list, but your average state representative is not. And that's the fundamental problem that Republicans have to contend with.
I mean, even in Arizona, in the dynamics of a purple state, you can even see how the different layers of government are reacting very differently. So Arizona has a state attorney general who's a Democrat, but is a former Republican and actually was a statewide elected official for years as a Republican. She has said she will not enforce that Civil War era law, but the Maricopa County attorney, who is a Republican, has said she might, right? And so you have these very odd dynamics even within the state, right? There's not alignment among Republicans between, say, that county attorney and Republican legislators who are now kind of like, whoa, we don't want to be associated with this. Let's not do this. Whoops, just kidding. And people like who are part of law enforcement. And for those state lawmakers, it becomes, you can see how this starts to affect everyone, right? This affects everyone. You know, many Republican state lawmakers, there was an opportunity to vote to repeal that 19th century law, and they voted against it. The same people who are now saying, wait, we shouldn't do this. They voted against it. And so where are they on this? But also in a state like Arizona, where both chambers of the state legislature are controlled by Republicans, but by extremely small margins. You have a Democratic governor. Democrats, other than the human element of making sure that women are safe and don't have sort of like horrible outcomes between now and when presumably the statewide ballot initiative that will almost certainly pass with flying colors gets enacted a year from now, whatever, months from now, you can really see that no one on either side has an interest in resolving this in the state legislature right now. Because if Republicans say, gosh, you know, okay, we are just kidding. We actually don't want this unbelievably draconian measure. So we are going to repeal this, right? And go back to the 15-week ban. If you're a Democrat, or even if you're Katie Hobbs, the governor, why would you sign that? You'd say like, no, put something on my desk where you give women much stronger protections in 15 weeks. Because you know what? At 15 weeks, that anyone who's ever been pregnant knows this, you don't even have your anatomy ultrasound until 20 weeks. 15 weeks is actually pretty early, right? And so that kind of line in the sand at 15 weeks, not acceptable, Katie Hobbs might say, or Democrats. And so no one has an interest right now in resolving this, because it is better for Democrats to have it be on the ballot in November and hopefully get better protections. And I mean, that's how the sausage is made. It's not nice, but it is how it is made.
It's a political reality.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, and that's the irony, is it would actually be pretty good politics for Republicans to pass this and put her in a position where she has to veto something that polls reasonably well or was the status quo previously. So yeah, everybody, the it's sort of a sort of game theory chess match that the equilibrium ends up being, let's just put a pin in it and duke it out in November.
Speaking of the Biden administration, you know, just doing something anyway and letting the courts shut him down. Earlier this week, President Biden announced his plan B for student loan forgiveness. But don't let plan B fool you. It's actually his fourth attempt, not his second. His first plan, which used the HEROES Act, would have canceled up to $400 billion for 43 million Americans, was struck down as unconstitutional in June 2023, using the pandemic emergency as pretext after the pandemic ended. It was widely criticized, including by our Democratic friends at Third Way, as inflationary, unfair, regressive, because it benefited the best educated citizens who have the highest earning potential and did nothing to address the root causes of sky-high tuition and student loan debt. This new plan is slightly narrower than the first. They have not released a top-line number yet, but it would help up to 30 million borrowers, reduce payments for 25 million borrowers, erase all debt for about 4 million others. A major component of this relief package is that it cancels up to $20,000 of the interest a borrower has accrued. Also, people who are eligible for but have not applied for loan forgiveness under existing programs, like the public service loan forgiveness, would simply have their debts canceled automatically. They wouldn't have to do anything. Borrowers with undergraduate debt who started repaying their loans more than 20 years ago and graduate students who started repaying them more than 25 years ago would also have their debts completely canceled. There's also some vague language about wiping out all debt for borrowers who attended, quote, low financial value programs or institutions, or who, quote, experience hardship paying their loan. This new plan does not use an emergency provision, but instead uses the Higher Education Act. So instead of blanket loan forgiveness, they are targeting as many specific groups of borrowers as possible. So here's a few choice quotes about it. Beth Akers, who's a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and studies the economics of higher education, said, on the margins, they're pushing to forgive debt in every manner possible and trying to find all the different places where they have some authority in order to make it happen. The economist Adam Looney, who served on President Barack Obama's Council of Economic Advisors, said, beneficiaries of student debt forgiveness would be higher income, better educated, and whiter than beneficiaries of just about all other programs designed to reduce economic hardship and promote economic opportunity. And lastly, Maya McGuinness, who's the president of the Committee for Responsible Federal Budget, said, you can't solve a very real debt problem by issuing more debt. The president's previous student loan cancellation plan was expensive, inflationary, poorly targeted, and would have boosted rather than reduced tuitions. This plan similarly misses the mark. So the TLDR is that it doesn't do anything to address the root problem of rising tuition and student loan debt. They want to spend money on people with high earning potential instead of low-income families and older Americans. And it's still not super likely the court will agree Biden can do this, although we don't know. In the meantime, college costs keep going up. And the New York Times reported this week that some students at Vanderbilt University will have nearly $100,000 in total expenses for the year. Average 2023 to 2024 list price for private school, nonprofit, four-year school is $56,000. For public in-state four-year degree, $24,030. So the question is, who's Biden trying to win here? Because he won white college-educated voters by 15 points in 2020.
I'm so glad that you put this on as a topic for the roundup today, because I mean, these previous topics, I just sounded like, you know, liberal to wild.
This is your wheelhouse.
And now you're just really, you've given me another opportunity to remind people that fundamentally I am a crotchety conservative. And so thank you so much, Ron. I think
it's my pleasure.
This is absolutely ridiculous and such a loser. And I don't understand why the Biden administration is doing this. And I think that it reflects, a desire within folks in his administration to further a part of their own agenda. I don't even believe this is something that Joe Biden, that this is like a deeply held view of Joe Biden, but some idea of what the progressive agenda should be that doesn't actually reflect political realities. It doesn't reflect voting blocks, from what I can tell. No one has ever shown me a poll that has caused me to believe that this is going to be a single motivating factor for people who otherwise would have voted against Joe Biden. I mean, show me that poll. That sounds craven, but you know, it's an election year. I've never seen that data. It actually kind of reminds me of something that Lene said on the show many months ago, where she was talking about some of the work that she does at Third Way, and she was talking about what kind of political forces promote candidacies of folks like the Squad, right? Mm. And that it's actually not, you know, Black and Brown voters. It's not low income voters. It's like, you know, limousine liberal types, or not limousine liberals. That's unfair.
Rich white liberals.
It's rich white college educated people. And that actually, when you then go and look at the sort of breakdown of those congressional districts, actually the people who these candidates supposedly most represent are like, no, we don't want to defund the police at all. No, thank you. Like, no, we actually, this is not our jam at all. And that may seem not directly related, but it reminds me of this, because ultimately this kind of proposal does not help any of the constituencies that we would want it to. It helps people who already, I mean, if you were a person who had the privilege of taking on hundreds of thousands of dollars in college student loan debt, that probably means that you were entering life in a lot better shape than many other people for whom college was not an option. And fundamentally, we could talk about all the things that are wrong with this policy proposal all day long, but fundamentally, the thing that it is especially offensive about it is that it does nothing to actually solve the fundamental problem of the student loan debt crisis. And we are, in proposal after proposal, just seeing mechanisms that ultimately just allow colleges, especially private colleges. Like, why would the federal government be in the business of helping private universities, some of which have, you know, like investment boards where people are like money managers making millions of dollars personally, right? Why are we doing something to subsidize those private entities, right? Why are we not focusing on making state universities very high quality and affordable? Why are we not focusing on investments in vocational schools? Exactly. There are so many things that we could be doing. And if you want to do that along with student loan debt relief, I think that's a different conversation. But this is just another example of something that I just don't think lands with most Americans.
So Liam, here's the question I put to you. So Democrats are already losing support from blue-collar workers across all races, and the vast majority, if not all, of the erosion that Biden has suffered since taking office has been from non-white working-class voters. So the fear is, as bad as this policy is, just, you know, on its merits, the optics of this can make it even worse for him if it looks like, you know, it's a giveaway to people who don't necessarily need it. So I'm concerned about how the Biden team obviously sees this as a political benefit, but it's unclear to me how.
You know, I mean, I would step back and say, to your point, like, this is something that Biden himself personally is deeply skeptical about. It's something that he had to be dragged to, and that they didn't really pop the cork on this until the months leading up to the 2022 midterms. I might look back at this and say they had such success in the 2022 midterms that anything that seemed to maybe work looks like something they can pull off the shelf and try to do again. But remember, this is kitchen sink time for the Biden administration. Things don't look good. They have a limited tool, you know, they have dials here and levers there, and they need to sort of twist and pull on whatever they can. That's part of it. But that skepticism that Biden personally has, and maybe like Biden Democrats have, runs into a fundamental underlying ideological motivation of the people he has staffed his administration with. This is a Warren administration in a lot of ways. And so, you know, I think that's the other piece of this, is you have lots of people in the administration that truly believe this is the right thing to do irrespective of politics. And when you have a campaign that's sort of desperately looking for anything that might work, and you have numbers that show you young people are among his weak spots, and he needs two things. He needs them to turn out more than they usually do, or at least in historical terms, as much as they tend to. And once they get there, he can't afford to lose them. He needs them to turn out for him, not for Kennedy, not for West or anybody else. And so, you know, I think the threshold here that he's trying to overcome is demonstrating that he cares, demonstrate that he's competent, and demonstrate that he's willing to act. And I think those are frustrations of all voters, that either Washington doesn't care, these guys are incompetent, they're old, whatever, or to the extent that they are, they're just not caring about things that matter to people like me. To our fundamental premise here, like, well, okay, but who does this satisfy? I don't think it satisfies anybody necessarily, but a lot of the groups want it. A lot of the, even you mentioned, you know, just the racial dynamics of, yeah, the you know, maybe this disproportionately helps, white families or voters or whatever, but there are a lot of African-American groups that think this is really important to them. So however it plays with voters, there are important constituencies and elements of the coalition that this does satisfy. So I think, you know, is it baldly political? Of course it is. Do they intend it to even go to an effect? Who knows? It didn't matter last time. But you know, I would put it in with the LNG pause, things that don't make sense from a policy basis, but satisfy some narrow niche of the coalition and is worth a shot because they are running out of time and they need to do whatever they can and flex their muscles to the extent they have them.
That's a really good point about the timing for this to take effect, assuming that there are no legal challenges, which there will be, and that don't delay that. Because this is not going out under the HEROES Act, there's no like sort of emergency priority being put on it. It's under sort of ordinary operating procedures. It's subject to what we call negotiated rulemaking, as per the Administrative Procedures Act. So they're subject to, I think, a year of public comment or something like that after they put the rule forward, which would be at the earliest something like November. So this has a long way to go before it actually takes effect because of this negotiated rulemaking. So this might be another one of those things, like you said, get caught trying, right? Like
and you get the press release
right,
now.
We go into the election with the thing not in effect, but at least I get to go, you know, wave it around like I'm actually doing something, and we'll see if it actually takes effect after the war.
And in the case of, you know, anything that's stopped by the courts, it doubles as an opening to your argument that it's too important. We need to elect Biden because we need to get rid of these activist Republican, you know, conservative judicial foes.
Yeah, I have a note from CJ here, just FYI. They're also losing a lot of support from non-white college-educated people. They're down 24 points with them compared to 2020, but they obviously make up a much smaller portion of the electorate than non-white, non-college-educated people. So, okay, now that we are caught up on a few of the biggest stories this week, there were a lot of stories this week. I can't wait to hear what you brought. Lucy?
So I'm reminded, as the election cycle heats up, that the idea that there could be a lane for moderate Republicans really just turns out not to be true. And so this is less of an under-the-radar story and just more of a reminder. There's a great piece in Slate this week by Ben Mathis-Lilly, and it's about the idea that all of the attempts by people like Mitch McConnell or the NRSC to take the wheel, quote unquote, back from Trump and nominate candidates who were strong, compelling Republican candidates for Senate, for example. That whole effort to nominate candidates who are not MAGA wackos, who are not Carrie Lakes, who are not Doug Mastriano types, is failing and is going to continue to fail. And I think it is this coupled with a couple of other pieces. I think there was a big piece in The Atlantic about the idea of like, oh, you know, all of these micro factions of people who could be anti-Trump Republicans, anti-MAGA Republicans, they're all out there. We just need to consolidate them, just like we can't consolidate people, apparently, who want a third party for the presidency. We really do not right now have the tools in our toolkit to actually consolidate anti-MAGA Republicans. And there are a couple of races where this has really come into view. One is in the Montana race, guy named Tim Sheehy, who's running for Senate there. Go look him up. It's becoming a doozy. But another one who arguably should have been even more compelling is a guy in Wisconsin named Eric Hovde, whose name has been floated in many previous cycles in Wisconsin. A lot of people hoped that Eric Hovde, Liam's raising his eyebrows, that yeah, Eric Hovde would run for governor in 2022, because everyone was like, oh my gosh, Eric Hovde is this moderate. He's not an election denier. He's a rich guy. He's a business guy. He's from Wisconsin. And actually, Wisconsin tried to do that with a different guy named Tim Michaels, who similarly rich, not crazy, and he lost, right? So now you have Eric Hovde running for U.S. Senate in Wisconsin. And in addition to some gaffes that are funny, like the fact that Eric Hovde said if it were up to him, he'd ban booze, which I don't think is going to be very popular in Wisconsin. He is now giving interviews where he promotes election denialism, where he says things like, he said that he believed that, you know, it was actually reasonable to believe that that the 2020 election had some big time irregularities. He wouldn't use the language of stolen, but he said that, you know, there were these troublesome irregularities, like the fact that there were high rates of participation of voters in nursing homes. You know, there's no way those people could have voted. They must have been too feeble to plausibly cast their own ballots. So this is really more like a warning to watch these people closely, because I think that we're going to see more and more Republican candidates this cycle who are supposedly the great white hope for anti-Trump, anti-MAGA Republicans who want to restore the olden days to the Republican Party. And these candidates are just going to keep showing us that they know where their bread is buttered, and it's buttered by the MAGA base.
Well, that was uplifting. but also true. Okay. Liam, what'd you bring?
So mine is the Congressional Review Act, and we're going to spend the next 6.5 months sort of white knuckling it through, you know, on these episodes, rounding up, you know, the polls of the day, the news of the day. But I think it's a useful, exercise to think through, okay, let's just say we wake up the Wednesday after the election and Donald Trump wins, the Republican Senate that we all expect, notwithstanding the folks that, that Lucy just mentioned, and they hold the House. What do they have the opportunity to do? Everybody knows about reconciliation. You know, we know that the filibuster keeps them from doing much in the legislative way. But the regulatory agenda is really critical, and I think overlooked oftentimes. One tool that they have that is actually interestingly playing out even this week, they've used the Congressional Review Act multiple times, because it's the one other mechanism you can use to get around the filibuster. In 1996, Congress passed the Congressional Review Act under Bill Clinton. It was signed into law. For about 20 years, it hung out there as just sort of a curiosity, not something anybody ever meaningfully used. I think it was used one time when the Bush administration came in and they nuked an OSHA ergonomics reg. But when Trump came in with a trifecta in 2017, they came out of the gate really hard. And the first 100 days, they took 14 what are called midnight regulations under the Obama administration and repealed them. They passed measures you know, disapproving of them. And what that means in the Congressional Review Act is not only is that regulation rescinded, but it cannot be repromulgated by future presidencies in a substantially similar form. All of which is to say it's a really powerful tool. It's asymmetrical in the sense that Republicans are apt to use it more than Democrats. And the Biden administration, particularly after 2017, is very aware of this. And so the way it works is there's a 60-day look-back window, 60 days beginning at the end of the Congress. And we're looking at where that 60 days might be. It's a moving target because nobody knows how deep into the lame duck they're going to go. But if you just look at the majority leader's schedule right now, it would begin in, let's say, mid to late May. So anything that the Biden administration finalizes on any issue, any agency rulemaking, the ones you mentioned under the Administrative Procedures Act, if it's made final after mid-May, it is apt to be repealed, rescinded, disapproved by a Republican Congress coming in 2025. So the administration knows this. They're trying to race these things to final stage. They need to get it into the Federal Register before then. But just this week, we had the joint employer rule from the DOL that's now been passed by the Senate and sent over to Joe Biden. He will veto that because under this configuration of power, this is just a messaging exercise. They did the same thing with the greenhouse gas emissions rule. There are a number of these things that are just playing out as political football. But come January of 2025, if Republicans have a trifecta, they will go back to this and use the CRA to revisit basically the entire Biden administrative record to the extent they can, anything that falls into that look back window. So that's something to keep in mind. I think it's one that will continue to be news because anything you hear about that becomes final from May on is susceptible and exposed to this tool. Just keep in mind the Congressional Review Act.
That's fascinating, Liam. That's a really good one. Okay. I just have a few things to blitz through really quick. I won't go into too many of these. There's so many things that I wanted to mention this week, but I'm watching the possibility for escalation with Iran. U.S. is now warning of an imminent missile attack on Iran by Iran on Israel, and Biden has now said Israel has our ironclad support to stand with to Israel against threats from Iran and its proxies. And I think as of yesterday, or maybe it's even today, a senior U.S. general is heading to Israel, unnamed senior U.S. general is heading to Israel to coordinate the threat. And they don't want to name him, I think, because of security concerns, him or her, because of security concerns. If this happens, this would likely draw us into direct hot conflict in the Middle East. So it's quite a serious situation. Also, Natasha Bertrand at CNN just tweeted, asked why the Biden administration is discouraging Ukraine from striking Russian energy infrastructure. Lloyd Austin, Secretary Lloyd Austin, acknowledges that the administration has concerns about how it will affect global energy markets. Quote, certainly those attacks could have a knock-on effect in terms of the global energy situation, Austin says. But quite frankly, I think Ukraine is better served in going after tactical and operational targets that can directly influence in the current fight. So Mark Polymeropoulos raised this up and said this hasn't received enough attention. The apparent U.S. position at a time when our aid package is stuck and Ukraine is desperate for battlefield success is so galactically stupid, shameful, and immoral, it's hard to comment. The hope, of course, is Ukraine ignores such concerns. I thought that was kind of astounding that we would be telling Ukraine not to choose energy targets because it could affect energy prices. Anyway, also inflation. Inflation is hot and sticky, and you might have seen a headline here or there that it's hot and sticky again, but the truth is, it's actually been rising for the last 6 months, and that's something you probably haven't seen. As of yesterday, it has come in higher than projected for three straight months. But the more interesting measure is the one it's a little bit controversial. Not all economists agree on it, but it's the one the Federal Reserve is watching very closely. It's called supercore inflation. Supercore basically just strips out all of the areas where there's a lot of price inflation, including in food, energy, and housing, because those tend to, they would say, exaggerate the level of inflation. So they strip them out and they try to get at what is supercore. And that is currently rising at an 8% annualized pace, and it's accelerating. That is, the three-month rate is higher than the six-month rate, and the six-month rate is higher than the one-year rate. So, why are people talking about this? Remember a few weeks back, I went on a tear about monetary policy and why the president's not supposed to influence it because it undermines the supposed independence of the central bank. And the markets have been pricing in rate cuts by the Fed up to three more as of the last meeting before the end of the year. That's now changed. And the market has now scaled that back to one rate cut before the end of the year. The market's not happy. And Larry Summers is saying that actually, you need to prepare yourselves for the possibility that the next rate move might be a hike, which would be a huge, huge deal. But the reason I'm mentioning this is that in the wake of all of this inflation alarm, Biden weighed in again on Federal Reserve policy, reaffirming his prediction that there will be a rate cut before the end of the year. And I explained the last time why that would be enormously good for him politically, but it's also deeply, deeply wounding to trust in the monetary system and sort of influencing what is supposed to be a completely independent project, which is the management of the supply of U.S. dollars. So I'll leave that there. Before we head over to Politicology Plus, where can we find you on the internet, Lucy?
I'm still hanging on Twitter, and I still call it Twitter at Lucy M. Caldwell.
Liam, how about you?
I'm back. I was off for Lent, and I dove back in a couple days ago at I will also call it Twitter at LP Donovan. But I was off the sauce for a while, and now I dove back in. There's no going back.
How does it feel to be back?
Awful and awesome at the same time. It's fun to catch up with people whose voices I hadn't heard of in a while, and it's tough. Like, I've done this every year for a better part of the last decade, but like it really is tricky to, on the one hand, it's refreshing because you get to experience life and news in the way of, that a normal person would and not a, a political obsessive. So it's more useful in terms of trying to channel what regular, regular people are thinking of. But it's also really tough anymore to replace the information flow that, that Twitter has come to represent. I mean, I think 10 years ago, I might have used more blogs or, you know, the RSS feed or whatever. And there were actually tools that could pull out of Twitter, like what I could be paying attention to instead of like the chatter. And Musk caught and killed all those and everything else sort of ate. And so it really is sort of a, you know, blissful ignorance, but ignorance nonetheless when you're off. So I'm happy to be back.
It's like carbs or like refined sugars. Like, you, you know, it's really better for you not to be consuming, but it's just so delicious.
I'm gorging for now.
All right, everybody. Thanks for listening today. If you have questions about anything we discussed today, you can reach us, as always, at podcast@politicology.com. Whether it's an episode idea, a topic recommendation, or just a simple note about what you thought, we love to hear from you, and we might even use it on an upcoming episode. Also, if you can head over to the Apple Podcast app and rate us 5 stars and leave a review there, we'd really appreciate it. This helps us rise in the rankings so that new people can discover Politicology organically. I'm Ron Steslow, and I'll see you in the next episode.